You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love. Hello. Today we are releasing an unlocked bonus episode along with an updated intro. This bonus covers the group called Synanon. If you enjoyed this episode, please become a Patreon member to access more content like this. Now, before we start the episode, a brief but important update. Recent investigations have renewed scrutiny of Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers for adopting Synanon-style techniques at the UFW compound La Paz, and he has also been accused of sexual abuse. Cesar Chavez founded the UFW in 1962 to address the brutal conditions faced by agricultural laborers. The organization's purpose centered on winning collective bargaining rights for farm workers who were excluded from the National Labor Relations Act, raising wages in an industry built on poverty-level pay, and improving working conditions, including pesticide exposure, heat, housing and access to water, building political power for a population that has been systematically disenfranchised, creating a moral movement, not just a labor union. Chavez framed the struggle as spiritual, sacrificial, and rooted in nonviolence. Chavez saw the UFW as both a union and a community, something closer to a moral crusade than a standard labor organization. From the outside, the association appeared to champion farm workers' rights, but history shows how any leader can take a worthy cause and steer it down a dangerous path. So, here's a quick update on Cesar Chavez and La Paz. What reporters have found? A major investigation has documented allegations that Chavez brought Synanon-influenced practices into the UFW's inner life, and that the La Paz compound developed a culture some former residents now describe as coercive and abusive. The reporting links the use of Synanon methods to patterns of control and secrecy at the compound, how the game functioned inside the UFW mechanics. The game. The game was a confrontational group process that developed at Synanon. It's kind of chilling in its practice. It involves long, high-pressure sessions where participants were publicly challenged, shamed, and pushed to confess or to change behavior. It can be done and sometimes found in some of these residential teen treatment places that we talk about on the show. Within the UFW, the leaders used the game to enforce discipline, break down individual resistance, and demand absolute loyalty from staff and residents. Sessions could be intense, emotionally destabilizing, and designed to replace private judgment with group authority. Former staffers and residents report that rank-and-file organizers, young volunteers, and women living at La Paz were among those most affected by those sessions and the broader culture they helped create. Some longtime UFW figures later described the environment as insular and controlling. The use of Synanon techniques shifted internal power dynamics, and dissent was discouraged, loyalty was enforced through public humiliation, and decision-making centralized around Chavez and his inner circle. And over time, that concentration of authority altered how the union operated internally. Chavez invited Synanon members to La Paz and incorporated their methods into the training there and into the discipline, and publicly praised aspects of Synanon's communal discipline during the period when the UFW was consolidating its headquarters and staff culture. As Synanon's behavior grew more extreme and public scrutiny increased, Chavez and the UFW moved away from formal ties, but the imprint of those techniques on La Paz and on some staff practices remained a subject of debate, and now a renewed investigation. In today's Unlocked episode, we trace Synanon's methods, its history, and the impact it continues to have today. Thanks for tuning in to our Patreon exclusive bonus episode. Listeners like you are the reason we keep the show going, so thanks so much for your support. And enjoy this bonus interview as our thanks to you. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for your wonderful support on Patreon. It is so, so, so much appreciated. I want to talk today about a group that has been in the news again, even though it was a group founded in 1958, so it hasn't existed in a long time, but still, it made news then, and it's continuing to make news now. It's called Synanon. And Synanon is this incredibly kind of benchmarky kind of group in that it was at the heart of so many ways that people learn to talk to each other, to do very aggressive kind of quote-unquote therapy with each other, to live with each other. The leader was a sociopath, and there are a lot of problems that people have had since leaving, but unfortunately, there have been a number of residential teen treatment places and other large group awareness trainings that have used some of their techniques, playing their own version of something called the game, which is this attack therapy, and is quite traumatizing. Synanon was founded in 1958 by Charles Diedrich Sr. as a response to the exclusion of drug addicts from Alcoholics Anonymous. So he wanted to be able to take care of them. Initially, it was called Tender Loving Care, and it was later incorporated as the Synanon Foundation.
The organization, which developed a successful business selling items, moved to larger facilities over time, including a beachside hotel in Santa Monica and a building in Oakland. I actually remember the hotel in Santa Monica. Synanon also welcomed professionals without drug addictions, including psychiatrist Daniel Castriel, who later founded Ariba and Daytop Village. Synanon was started by Charles, who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the time of Synanon's founding, those suffering from drug addiction were not always welcome in AA because their issues were considered significantly different from those of alcoholics, even though we've talked on the show before, and I'll be happy to say it again, that most people who are labeled alcoholics in Alcoholics Anonymous are not alcoholics. Diedrich, after taking LSD, decided to create his own program to respond to their needs, and he was said to have coined the phrase, "Today is the first day of the rest of your life." So, notice the irony already, that he started a place for people who had drug addiction after he took LSD and got the idea from being on an LSD trip. Okay? So, he was said to coin the phrase, "Today is the first day of the rest of your life," after his small group called Tender Loving Care gained a significant following. Diedrich incorporated the organization into the Synanon Foundation in 1958. And so people don't really know why it was called Synanon. They try to think about maybe it was a combo of symposium and seminar. Not sure. But now it has a kind of nefarious association. It became a very successful enterprise, making about $10 million a year, especially from selling their promotional items. That's a lot of money at any time, but especially in the 1950s. And then they moved to their headquarters. And as the group grew, the leader, I think, also showed his true colors more and more. It acquired a large building that had been the home of the Athens Athletic Club in Oakland, California, and then transformed into a residential facility for Synanon members. And so even those without drug addictions were invited to join. There was then this very disturbing shift that took place. Synanon required a strong initial commitment from newcomers, including quitting drugs cold turkey, not a good idea, and ceasing contact with outsiders for the first 90 days, also not a good idea. Only if the person that you're barred from talking to is your dealer or someone who makes you upset to the point where you want to use, but it also kept people from being able to inform those on the outside about what was happening to them on the inside. Initially, members went through a 1 to 2 year program in three stages. And a key practice was the game, a form of attack therapy where members endured intense, and I mean intense, criticism to promote personal change and gather community opinions, being screamed at, being backed up against a wall. It was truly traumatizing. Over time, this practice was used coercively, and the founder, Charles Diedrich, envisioned Synanon as a means to promote social progress, establishing an innovative school to educate children in a progressive manner. Entrance into the Synanon community required that everyone made a commitment for a long stretch of time. And what happened also was that people who got involved were then told to be a part of their lifetime rehabilitation program. And the premise was that drug addicts would never be kind of truly well enough to return to society. Not a true thing to say or to think. When also the game, quote unquote, was used, one member would talk about themselves and then endure intense criticism by their peers, by the leader of the game to the staff person. During this practice, members were encouraged to be critical of everything, including harsh and profane language being used. And the practice has been criticized in many ways as being horrific and not something that helps people in the slightest, but has been adopted by a lot, unfortunately, of other centers. And it's called other things in other places, but basically the premise is that you intimidate people into change. What happens in those moments is there really isn't change per se, but there is the need to survive that moment. So you will say or do whatever you need to do to survive that moment, akin to torture. And because there's no hierarchy in the game, members could freely criticize Synanon's highest leadership too, who would then take member concerns into consideration when deciding policy. Not sure if that they really took things into consideration, but maybe they did. The game turned into a, get this, 72-hour version of it and was admitted by Diedrich to be brainwashing. That's actually what he called it. It was used to make people submit. And he also then started having very strict rules on everyone, like telling people to abort pregnancies, to undergo vasectomies, or to commit violence. Over time, Diedrich's vision, as he changed, I think, became sicker. His vision of Synanon evolved, and he began to envision the group's potential to promote social progress, which I still don't quite know what that means to him, what social progress means to him. Synanon moved to create schooling for members, and Diedrich wanted members to mentally change in order to improve society on the outside. The school was headed by Al Bauman, who believed in an innovative philosophy and aimed to teach children in the same manner to think differently. It attracted lawyers and screenwriters and business executives, all wanting to educate their children in a progressive environment, many of whom took their children out eventually and also sued the organization. Then, as we can suspect with where this was going, there was escalating violence. Synanon, which was supposed to be initially nonviolent, became increasingly violent under Diedrich's leadership, with over 80 violent acts committed by its, quote-unquote, listen to this term, Imperial Marines. Notable incidents include the severe beating of ex-member Phil Ritter and the rattlesnake attack on attorney Paul Morantz, which led to a law enforcement investigation. I remember hearing all about this rattlesnake attack on the attorney who was fighting a battle against Synanon. Diedrich's recorded threats and Synanon's aggressive legal actions against the press ultimately contributed to its downfall. Diedrich and two members were arrested for the snake attack, and Diedrich received probation due to ill health. Synanon's tax-exempt status was revoked, don't know why it ever had that, leading to its bankruptcy and dissolution in 91. It is an incredible thing to watch how things transform. And when people come to me and they say, oh, an organization seems fine, I think that maybe you're being too critical of it, I will still keep track as much as I can. If I feel like the leader has the need to take control or is getting more paranoid in their thinking or more militant in their thinking, having more of an us versus them mentality, because the group then often becomes sick in these ways. In the mid-1970s, NBC Nightly News produced a segment on the controversies surrounding Synanon, and following the broadcast, several NBC executives, including the network's chairman, allegedly received hundreds of threats from Synanon supporters. And after the rattlesnake attack on the attorney who was fighting a case against Synanon, the Los Angeles Police Department performed a search of the ranch that found a recorded speech by Diedrich in which he said, "We're not going to mess with the old-time turn-the-other-cheek religious postures. Our religious posture is, don't mess with us. You can get killed dead, literally dead. These are real threats." And then he said, "They're draining life's blood from us and expecting us to play by their silly rules. We will make the rules. I see nothing frightening about it. I am quite willing to break some lawyers' legs and next break his wife's legs and threaten to cut their children's arm off. That is the end of that lawyer. That is very satisfactory. That's a humane way of transmitting information. I really do want an ear in a glass of alcohol on my desk. Okay, so this is a person who was setting up schools and curriculum and trying to make the world a better place and living in a more progressive way. Says how much some of these people are all talk, and their talk is quite contrary to who they really are and what their principles really are. So the lawsuits that started coming were a large part of Synanon's undoing by giving journalists access to Synanon's own internal documents. Lots of newspapers covered a lot of these cases. And then as a result of the snake attack, Diedrich and two Synanon residents, Joe Musico and Lance Kenton, son of the musician Stan Kenton, were arrested and pleaded no contest to charges of assault and conspiracy to commit murder. Lance Kenton was sentenced to a year in prison while his associates went to jail. Diedrich received probation because his doctors claimed that due to ill health, he would most likely die in prison. And as a condition of probation, he was disallowed from taking part in managing Synanon. He did die in 1997 after a series of strokes. Synanon struggled to survive without its leader and also with its severely tarnished reputation. Then the IRS revoked the organization's tax-exempt status and told that it had to pay $17 million in back taxes. So here we go. Here's the part that really matters. I mean, all of that matters. But here's the part that really matters because so many places are still using some of these techniques. Breaking down the psychological techniques used by Synanon to control members is a really important thing to do here, because as we see, it's something that can actually cause a whole bunch of need for therapy and trauma. Then you have the isolation, separating members from the outside, behavior modification. Synanon used rewards and punishments to shape members' actions, and a key practice, of course, was the game. And thought control. Members were discouraged from critical thinking or questioning Synanon's teachings, not actually listening to any of the news reports or reading any of the legal briefings on what had happened there. And the group promoted its ideology as absolute truth. Then there was love bombing. You are one of us. We are kind of this chosen group. We are the people who are going to make the world make sense somehow, while everyone else is busy running around doing things the old way. There is this own form of therapy. You have to stay in-house. You can't go to see a therapist, I think even a doctor, outside the group. You have to make a lifetime commitment. There's also escalating violence, which was absolutely considered justifiable and justified. And there was a charismatic leader and extreme practices. And so what we want to do here is we want to, of course, think about the people who were severely harmed by Synanon and some people who were able to escape. But it brings me back to this idea of consent, this newer idea added to the definition of consent, that in order for consent to be meaningful in a legal way, you need to give ongoing consent based on new information. When people first got involved in Synanon, it seemed like a place that they could go for help, where they were being excluded from other places. Like if you had an addiction issue that was not about alcohol, you couldn't go to AA and you needed to find another place. And so it's a place where you felt you had a family, where you had acceptance, where you could get the assistance that you needed. But over time, it transformed. And there were a lot of people who were told that they couldn't leave or told themselves they shouldn't leave because they had made their initial commitment, their lifetime commitment. And they had to hold up to their own sense of integrity about that. But I think you only need to uphold your commitment to something if it continues to be the same something. if it continues to be the same organization with a leadership that remains having the same ideals and ideas and motivations and actions. But if it starts to change, then it's no longer the organization that you made your commitment to, which I think should free you of your kind of bondage there of feeling like you can't leave or that it would be wrong of you ethically, morally, in terms of your core, to leave something you had made a commitment to. Notice the changes. If you're involved in a relationship with someone who has severely changed, if you're involved in an organization that has changed, really reevaluate the commitment and if how the relationship has changed or how the group has changed is the thing that you still feel comfortable and right having made an initial commitment to. If it has changed so much and did that without your consent, then you don't owe it your devotion any longer. Thank you again for your wonderful support of the podcast. Talk to you soon. Thanks again for listening to our Patreon bonus episode. Your support is crucial to keeping the show on the air. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow us on Twitter and Instagram for more content and resources. Be well, and I'll talk to you soon.